The biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make is to fall in love with what they're doing. The only thing I want an entrepreneur to be attached to and fall in love with is their customer. Somebody's going to pay you because you care about them so much and you're always trying to solve their problems.
Welcome to the Authentically Successful Show, an entrepreneurship podcast that delivers you real stories and advice from successful founders and CEOs in various industries. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, a longtime professional recruiter, executive coach, thought leader, and creator of talent-centric organizations. Enjoy the show.
Joining me today is Steve Hoffman, fondly known as Captain Hoff, chairman and CEO of Founders Space, a global venture builder for entrepreneurs, corporations, and investors with over 50 partners in 22 countries. Steve is also a venture investor, founder of 3 venture-backed and 2 bootstrap startups, and author of several award-winning books. These include Make Elephants Fly, Surviving a Startup, and The 5 Forces. In Silicon Valley, Hoffman founded several startups in the areas of games and entertainment and worked as mobile studio head for InfoSpace with such hit mobile games as Tetris, Wheel of Fortune, Tomb Raider, Thief, and others. Steve went on to launch Founderspace with the mission to educate and accelerate entrepreneurs. Founderspace has become one of the top startup hubs in the world. Steve has trained hundreds of startup founders and corporate executives in the art of innovation and provided consulting to some of the world's largest corporations, including Qualcomm, Huawei, Bosch, Intel, Disney, Warner Brothers, and more. Steve and I first had an interview that was published in November of 2021, so a little over 2 years ago. By the time this is published, it'll probably be 2.5 years. And I wanted to have him on again because, Steve, you're an interesting guy and you're doing a lot of stuff and you're doing a lot of stuff in AI. Not that we haven't heard enough about AI these days, but wanted to talk to you a little bit more about that. So welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Carol. It's fantastic to be back.
Yeah. So let's just start for anybody who hasn't heard our first interview. In the intro, talked a little bit about some of the things you've done, but tell me a little more deeply about your journey to where you started to realizing that an organization like Founderspace is so necessary.
So I have been an entrepreneur. I've been in the trenches. I've done 3 venture-funded startups, 2 bootstrap startups. I know how tough it is for entrepreneurs. I had my share of ups and downs over the years. And, you know, after my 3rd venture-funded startup, I was literally just taking a break. I decided I need a break. And so I would invite friends out who are entrepreneurs in San Francisco to come out for coffee. And we would talk about their businesses. I would give them feedback. And then it just kept growing. And so we started what we call roundtables, where we'd meet in a coffee shop with more people. And those kept growing, where we had more and more entrepreneurs. And then we got our own space in San Francisco. And we named that Founder Space. And I started a blog. And things just took off. They took off like crazy. And really, we were one of the earlier startup accelerators in San Francisco. And our niche was we saw a lot of entrepreneurs coming to Silicon Valley from other places, many from overseas. And we wanted to make it really easy for them to land in Silicon Valley and get going fast. Because if you know about Silicon Valley, the one thing you know is that upwards of like 60%, over 60% of all startups in Silicon Valley have an immigrant co-founder. So it's 60? Huge, right? Yes.
Wow, I 60. Did not realize that.
Yes. So, well, you know, Silicon Valley is a magnet for the world. And so we were bringing in entrepreneurs from all over the world, helping them get set up here. Then I started to go abroad. We were working all across Europe, you know, in Germany and Netherlands and Austria, and then also all over Asia and, you know, South Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, you name it, we've been there. And it just kept going. And that today, I think we, you know, our kind of mission, to be simple, is a bridge between Silicon Valley and the rest of the world. That's what Founder Space is.
Interesting. So you said you were one of the earlier ones, right? I mean, now we know there's so many more, and I could name several of them, as I'm sure you can as well. If you kind of compare yourself to the other, you know, the other outfits doing this, what are the differences between what you're doing and what they might be doing?
A few differences. One is most of the other ones are local focused. So YC, Y Combinator, probably the most famous one. They have entrepreneurs from all over the world, but they're really based in Silicon Valley. The big thing about us is we have set up partnerships and offices and collaborations all over the world. So we are, you know, in 22 countries now. We work very closely with different governments, you know, like the government of South Korea, the government of Austria, the government of the Netherlands. We'll work very closely with them and their entrepreneurs in basically doing two things. One, they're smart people all over the world. Most other countries, like you take a country like Singapore or South Korea, you know, they're small. Their entrepreneurs have to look outside their home market. You know, there's not going to be a huge market in Singapore for your products. It's going to be a very, very small market. Yet there are a lot of talented entrepreneurs there. So they need help in getting, how do I access the U.S. market? What do I do when I come into the U.S. market? How can I raise capital in this market to grow? These are questions they have, and that has been our particular focus.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. You know, that, I mean, but you mentioned Y Combinator, of course, it's very well known. And of course, I immediately go to Techstars because I'm here in Colorado, right? So I think that, you know, I wonder, are they just not doing as much overseas? Because to your point, there are smart people everywhere, right? Why should they be forced to move to Silicon Valley to build a company?
So why should anybody move to Silicon Valley? I mean, you could do it in Colorado. Mm-hmm. You can do it in, you know, Berlin.
Well,
you
right.
can do it in Tokyo. But Silicon Valley is very special in a couple ways. So number one, the concentration of capital is much higher in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, as we've seen with AI, tends to take the lead on pushing the envelope with new technologies. So you're going to be right at the epicenter when those new technologies are born. You're going to be gaining a huge competitive edge. Silicon Valley is very open culture. So you go to other places and they're much more closed. Like it's much harder in most, like I spent a month working with entrepreneurs in Vienna, Austria. And it's a fantastic place to live, fantastic, entrepreneurs there, very, very hard to raise capital. The entrepreneurs are always saying, you know, it's hard to get the local venture capitalists mm-hmm. to take risks. Mm-hmm. And when you get them to take risks, it's hard to get enough money to actually scale up and grow a big business. So they struggle, and that's in their dream. The second part of the equation is it's a dream, right? People all over the world have heard of Silicon Valley. They've heard of all the amazing things that come out, and they want to experience the dream. So, and a lot of them are young. You know, there's a lot of them are single, and they can uproot much more easily and take a chance, and a lot of them do.
Yeah. So is what I'm hearing here, smart entrepreneurs make the move to the United States to build their companies?
Not necessarily. It depends on your company. So when I go abroad and work with entrepreneurs, which I do all the time,
yeah.
I will look at their business very carefully. And I will tell them honestly, because it's a huge financial decision for most of them to even come to Silicon Valley for a few weeks. It's so expensive,
right.
You know, mm-hmm. and they're usually very tight on money. Where could they best allocate their money? A lot of them, I'll say, you're just not ready. You are not ready to make the move. Others, I'll say, you do not have something that's special. Like, you're not going to be able to compete. Silicon Valley is going to crush you. Like, you better, you know, maybe you could be a small startup in your home country doing what you're doing, but you come to Silicon Valley, you're going to be outcompeted.
Get squished. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you'll get squished. And others, I will say, you're right. This is perfect for Silicon Valley. Like, what you're doing, if you come over now, you have something and you can grow it. So there's no one size answer that fits all. You have to look very at the details of their business. Is it right for the Silicon Valley? Is it right for the US market? Are they the type of entrepreneur who can navigate it? If they don't have the language abilities, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, in America, if you don't speak English, really hard to raise capital and grow your business. Very, very hard. So, and some of them don't. So I tell them through a translator, stay where you are.
Okay. Yeah, very interesting. So, right, because you're going to countries where, you know, they probably don't speak English and you don't speak whatever it is that they're speaking.
Well, most of them do speak English. So if I'm meeting with them, you know, we work hand in hand with a lot of governments. So the government will have funded a program. They'll have pre-selected their best entrepreneurs, what they think are their best entrepreneurs. I will go in for sometimes a week, sometimes 2 weeks. I will meet with them. I'll review their business plans. I'll give lectures. We'll, you know, work through all the basics. And at the end of that time, I'll give them, I'll give them my advice on what next steps they should take. And so these are supposedly, you know, the top entrepreneurs, young companies in the country. But still, even out of that selection, a lot of them are not prepared, or not, they just don't have what it takes to come to Silicon Valley and actually survive.
Right. So when you say, Steve, they're not prepared and they don't have what it takes, give me an example of what you mean by that.
So, and this is true for entrepreneurs everywhere. So,
well, I didn't want to interrupt you. That actually was was the part B of my question. This is, I'm sure, it's true of every entrepreneur. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're coming from Iowa. Mm-hmm. or Africa, you know, the fundamentals are the same. So what I'm teaching entrepreneurs, you know, and we work with American entrepreneurs too, of course. It just, you know, kind of, you ask what our specialty or our differentiation is, and it's that we get a lot of overseas entrepreneurs and have a lot of relationships. But, you know, when I analyze a business for what it takes to actually be successful, there are a few things I look at. One, you've got to, and it's really hard if you don't have this. You've got to have a company that is riding the current technological wave. Right now, it's AI. And I will tell you, AI companies are getting funded. If you're not AI right now, extremely hard to get funded. I mean, you can have a very, very, very good business, and a lot of the capital will just overlook you because capital tends to flow in waves, right? Not a steady stream to all these different sectors. When a sector is hot, all the money chases it. And so all the money's chasing AI right now. So, and there's a reason to, because these tech, the internet came, right? Huge wave, right? All the early internet companies, which were online first, they have a chance because it's blue oceans, right? It's wide open.
Yep.
You can go in there and you can carve up that space and become a dominant player. Then there was mobile, and you know, all the first mobile apps had a huge opportunity. So all the investors were going in on mobile. We see this over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Right now, it's AI. So if you can take artificial intelligence, which is just a technology, which on its own doesn't do anything, it's just a technology, but you can apply it to a very hard business problem and create an extreme amount of value, like in that one area, you have a chance of totally upending that industry. And so what we're looking at now is people taking AI and applying it across the board to all these different sectors and industries and totally changing the way they do business. That is the opportunity. So you have to have that. Number two, you have to have a really great team. And this is, I don't just look at the CEO, because the CEO, it can be great. But a great CEO to me is somebody who's picked out, surrounded themselves by, recruited, convinced to join them, absolutely amazing people. So I judge the CEO in part on who have they, if all their team is weak or they're trying to do it all themselves, I know there's a problem. Like the CEO is making bad choices.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that because, you know, I think over the years of, you know, when I was still a professional headhunter, and that's what I was doing for a living, you know, working with so many startups, right? And I would always say to people, the most important thing you need to be looking at and considering going to a startup is who's the team.
Absolutely.
That is the most important thing before you even know what the product is.
Yeah, I don't even care about what the idea. I tell entrepreneurs, before you come up with an idea, before you write one line of code or build anything, spend 80% of your time not trying to come up with the best idea in the world, because it probably won't be, you'll probably end up changing that, trying to raise money, doing all these other distractions, 80% of your time looking for the right people. Who are these amazing people that you're going to surround yourself with? And once you get all these amazing people together, you can almost not fail, right? Because if you get enough smart people together, you're going to figure something out with the right set of talents, like somebody who's really technical, somebody who understands marketing, somebody who understands design and user experience. You get these people together and things just happen. So I'm looking at that team. And then the CEO, though, is really important. Number one, they have to be able to type a person who's a leader, who can recruit and retain and inspire this team. That's number one. Number two, I want the leader especially, but as well as the whole team, to be very curious, to always be asking questions. So I see a lot of people who are just copycats. Like literally, they see something that's taking
the red
off.
Ocean. Hence the red ocean.
Yeah, and they end up saying, oh, we're going to do that because that's taking off. And they do this their whole career, right? Mm-hmm. They may be fine in a big corporation because big corporations just tend to copy because they're seldom first in these things. But in an early stage startup, if you're copying, you're dead. Like copycats die. So I'm looking for people who are always questioning their industry. Like whatever they're doing, wherever they are applying their talents and their technology and their innovation, I want to see them asking fundamental questions about this. So I will talk to them and literally probe them. Like, what do you understand about your business that is different from everybody else? What do you see? Why is this opportunity so special? How will this technology change things in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now? If they can't answer those questions, that's when I get a little worried. Because then, you know, if what they're doing and how they're thinking isn't fundamentally different from other people, they don't have anything. Because you, as a startup, you only win in two ways. I can say it very clearly. Two ways that startup wins. So number one is if you're different. If you come up with an idea or apply a technology in a way that nobody else is doing right now, and you're one step ahead of them, and you can use that first mover advantage and that domain expertise, that deep domain expertise, to actually grow your business fast enough to push aside competitors. Number two, if you can't do that, you have to be exponentially better. Like you have to be not incrementally better, because if you're just incrementally better, other people are in the marketplace already, they're going to way pass you up. You're never going to catch up being just like, oh, I have this little feature. I have this. When I say exponentially better, I mean, you've picked one thing that is super valuable and you do that thing two times, three times, four times better, because that is the only way to get customers to switch to a new company, right? There's so much inertia out there. None of us want to change the applications we're using. Whatever we're using, we don't want to change. So, and unless there's a significant reason, you're not going to grow. So I look at those things, and if all those things come together, then I'm on board. I'm on board to work with this startup.
I want to talk a little bit more. I want to talk a lot more about startups, but I want to talk a little bit more right now about AI and, you know, your point that, you know, AI startups are getting funded like crazy. This is sort of the as you said, right? It was, you know, there was mobile apps, and then before mobile apps, it was the internet. And, you know, there's been several things since then, but it's always like the great pile on, right? And sometimes that great pile on is not people lose a lot of money. Right. Oh, yeah. And I'm not suggesting that's going to happen in AI, although it's going to probably happen in AI. A lot of people can lose a lot of money, but you know, I have to wonder the venture capitalists handing out cash. Some are better than others, as we know, right? I mean, there's certain firms that are famous for, you know, making more good decisions than bad ones, right? And, you know, I have to wonder if this great pylon on AI isn't going to be super dangerous. I worry.
Been many great pylons in the past. So, yeah. You know, we all when virtual reality first came out, everybody and their brother was entranced by virtual reality. And it was amazingly cool. I remember when the first VR company walked into Founderspace and I got to try on the headset, and nobody even knew what it was at the time. These guys were they were at USC at the same time Oculus was. And they knew those guys and they had their own competing one. And, literally 2 weeks later, I helped them raise $5 million in Silicon Valley so they could launch their company. So it was very, very easy because the timing was right. The team was right. Everything was right. But, VR never materialized in the way everybody expected. And a lot of times, investors are smart, but they're also dumb. We're herd animals. We tend to follow the herd.
Well, right. The nation of sheep, as I always refer to it.
We're a nation. Right. And that's what human beings are. So every nation is that way. Groups tend to do that. People feel safer. People validate each other. But what you really want is market validation. So at the beginning, like most people in Silicon Valley, I was bullish on VR. I tried the headset. It was a game. I thought, this is cool gaming experience, right? If nothing else, this is going to be great for games. And then what happened was really interesting. I early on soured on VR. And I'll tell you why. Because when the first headsets came out, there wasn't a mass adoption, right? People were basically speaking with their pocketbooks. They were saying, this is interesting, but it's a niche market. Like gamers tend to like VR, but you go beyond gaming, really tough. There's some industrial uses and they make some money, but they're very hard to scale. They don't make a lot of money, when you're using them for, training doctors or different things like that. In factories, training people, they're used, but they're really hard businesses to scale. And so this became apparent actually years and years and years ago, shortly after VR launched, when the first headsets came out, the writing was there on the wall that there isn't going to be a mass consumer adoption of VR. This didn't stop Facebook from pumping billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, I was just thinking about
VR.
That, right.
They lost billions and billions. Lots of companies lost billions, and we're still seeing with the new AR augmented reality glasses. Yep. Apple has its Vision Pro, and Facebook has their little funky glasses. Nobody wants to wear this stuff, and it's like, didn't you get the message? Like, 5 years ago when the market didn't materialize, that this isn't ready for people yet. The technology isn't there. The user experience isn't there. It's fundamentally different. So, I'm a skeptic in a lot of things. So I wasn't bullish on that. And I saw people were going to lose money. Yet a lot of big companies think differently. A lot of big companies think we can afford to lose the money, but we can't afford to not be in the market. So they will, like Apple, they will spend the money, even though they don't expect it to be a huge hit, because they want to be up on what's happening. AI was fundamentally different. You can come back to me 5 years from now or even 1 year from now and talk to me. And AI is different than these technologies. So I think AI is different from VR, and it's also different from blockchain. Like everybody was talking about blockchain. It could solve every problem on the earth, right? Everything had to be decentralized. I was like, no, blockchain is great for cryptocurrency if you want cryptocurrency, right? That's a gambler's game.
Many people want nothing to do with, right.
Well, it's basically speculation, right? So if you want to speculate wildly, you can go to cryptocurrency. But blockchain applied to almost everything else was hot air, because it was not a technology that made a big difference. Most people want centralized databases. And so I didn't invest in blockchain companies per se, because I thought it's not going to solve those problems. AI is totally different. And let me explain. I'm very bullish on AI. Now, AI is different because it's a broad technology. Whereas blockchain was very narrow, did a few things well. VR is very narrow, actually. It does a few things that are really cool, like absolutely amazing, just like blockchain does a few things that are really, really cool. But very hard to apply VR to a wide set of problems, because like it's clunky. Nobody wants to wear the headsets for long. They're awkward. Nobody even wants to wear glasses. Like you and I wear glasses, we have to, but it's not like we want to. And people don't want extra gadgets on their face. It's just something people don't want. AI is different because literally every business process in the world, every action we take can be made smarter. through AI. It can literally impact every vertical business segment. And data has proved extremely valuable in the sense that data does a lot of things. Like, we already can see it with ChatGPT. But even before this, like, data can allow you to make predictions that a human brain simply cannot do, right? We can't look in, you know, a big part of humanity is the ability to look into the future and predict what will happen, you know, with anything, supply chains, stock markets, people, now Google, DeepMind, they have technology that can predict when a liver will fail, like when your liver will fail, like pretty amazing stuff. Extremely valuable. AI is valuable in inventing, you know, all the new biotech companies that are, you know, want to understand how to put together a new drugs. AI is indispensable. You can't really name a business sector where AI isn't going to play a fundamental role in defining that sector. So when you look at the money going into AI, yes, people will lose money. Things get overinflated. Certain companies, you know, get their stock price gets driven up. Certain investments won't pan out. But the overall net gain will be far greater than the capital loss in this case.
Right. And listen, I mean, we use it in my business, and I know many people who do, right?
Marketing, it doesn't matter what you do.
Right. I think the question is, because I am now perpetually, because it is the new shiny object, right? I'm perpetually getting, you know, emails, LinkedIn messages, you know, people trying to sell me AI stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, stop it.
Yeah. I mean, look at the new Samsung phone, AI everywhere. Look at every new laptop. It's the AI laptop. Well, you know, that's just marketing. Let's face it.
Well, people, of course it is.
People, you know, every business now says they have AI, whether they use it effectively or not, they're all touting it.
Right. Yeah,
but you got to push that stuff aside. You know, that's the hype. But there, what I'm saying is, below that hype, there is real value being created, and it's not a small amount of value. It's a huge industry-changing amount of value.
Yeah, right. So what about AI worries you?
So much. So much about AI worries me. Literally, AI is extremely powerful. And let me just give you a few examples of things that really, really worry me. So right now, people don't even know this, but AI is being used in the court system, in our justice system. It has been used to actually make decisions about whether prisoners should be released from prison on parole. Now, we all know humans are flawed, right? Humans make poor decisions, and we all often parole criminals that end up committing horrendous crimes again.
Yep.
So let's say AI could be better than human beings. Should we use it? And it's a moral question, which is really, really difficult. And this is what scares me. Because on one hand, if AI performs better than human parole committees, right, parole board, and deciding whether a prisoner should be out, that will, the net benefit to society will be significant, right? Less people will be released and actually commit crimes and have to go back to prison. And the right people will be let out. However, we know AI makes mistakes. We know AI is biased. Data is biased. And they actually found that the data being used in the AI was biased. It was actually keeping more people of color in prison than white people.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's funny that you mentioned that. And I, doggone it, I wish I could remember the name of the company that does the facial recognition that a lot of law enforcement companies, they're very stealthy. And there's a woman, a journalist who wrote a book about it. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. I just am completely drawing a blank. She was interviewed probably on Fresh Air on NPR. And, I was fairly mortified. I mean, you know, there's an address, but there's no real office there. And I mean, all very, very stealthy, right? And to your point about, you know, people of color being, that's exactly what their facial recognition, it has caused people to be arrested that have no business being arrested.
So these technologies are getting more and more, they're proliferating. So there's a company now, a startup now, that creates AI for cameras, for these CCTV cameras that go, these cameras that are in all the stores.
All over London and places like that? Yeah.
Yeah, all over London. In every convenience store, they have one. Every supermarket, every, department store. If you walk into a store, it can look at how you walk, how you move, and it can determine before you do it whether you are going to likely to steal something, whether you are likely to shoplift, and it can alert the store. Now, if you're a merchant,
at what percentage of accuracy, though, Steve?
Yes, that's the question, right? Even if it's, let's say they get it up to 99% accuracy, right? That's still 1 out of 100 people is going to be falsely identified as a criminal before they even do anything. And will they be, every time they walk into a store, will somebody be trailing them? Like, that would be so annoying if you were that person.
And it sort of removes the innocent till proven guilty piece, that we live on in this country.
Right. So this is being rolled out in India right now. This technology is being rolled out in India. It was developed by an Israeli company. And, it's amazing technology, absolutely amazing. And you could see it, people, one use may be you put it into cameras that are outside buildings at night that are closed to see if there's a burglar coming, right? And identify a burglar, call the police before the person actually steals anything.
Right.
Could be very good. But all of these technologies have real problems. So when people ask me, are you worried about AI? I am. Also, think about these large language models are super, super powerful. Now Facebook, Meta, is open sourcing their large language model, meaning people can download it and use it all over the world. Terrorist organizations, criminal governments like North Korea, Russia can use these. What does this mean? If they want to create, if a new country like Iran wants to create a nuclear weapons program, can it just download a large language model and begin to use it to create one, feed it its own data? These are all possibilities. We're living in a scary world. We're living in a world of disinformation. We already have a massive disinformation problem, in this country and all over the world, where people are saying fake news. Now we can use AI to create fake news in mass quantities.
The deep fakes. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, to disseminate this, and including video and audio, they can perfectly clone voices now. They can, they cloned Biden's voice in the New Hampshire primaries and had him say something, don't go to the polls. These are real problems. A lot of people like Elon Musk will be, I'm worried about AI taking over the world, like taking over humanity, like with its own volition. I'm not worried about that. That's a sci-fi novel. That's the chance of that happening anytime soon is really remote. Right. So it's a false flag. He's like just saying, oh, this is going to happen. Don't focus your attention on AI taking over the world. Focus your attention on how human beings, corrupt people in government, corrupt people, organizations, criminal organizations, use this technology to change the political landscape, to take away people's freedoms, and to manipulate people in very, very subtle but very powerful ways. That is what we should be concerned about.
We could spend hours talking literally just about that.
So you asked me, I told you.
No, I know. I mean, it, like I said, we could continue on this on that exact subject, right? About I just heard a story. It was last week on NPR about, and they produced two deepfakes, one of Biden and one of Trump. And I thought,
easy to do.
Very easy to do. And they told you they were deepfakes, right? I mean, they said it several times in the interview so that people understood these were not real. And it's interesting, in listening to them, they're really good. And I think, now, of course, I knew ahead of time that it was a deepfake. Everybody else did listening to it. And I thought to myself, yeah, I think this doesn't sound right and that doesn't sound right on what both of them were saying. And I thought, this is clearly a lie. But how many people in this country are just going to believe everything that they hear?
People want to believe certain things. When you target something at somebody that wants to believe, a certain politician is evil or a certain politician would say a certain thing and that politician does, they're like, they'll just accept it. And also, they aren't told in advance it's a deep fake. So they are naturally susceptible. They're not going to be as critical. They're not going to look at it in the same way you did. And, you know, for democracies around the world, it's a real challenge. And it's a challenge that we need to address now, because this technology is literally, I could go out there and I can clone anybody's voice. And I can start to use that in nefarious ways. Could be political. I can clone voice. Imagine these scammers who want to scam you out of money. They can clone your sister's voice, your brother's voice, your friend's voice, calling you up and saying, I need money, please. It's an emergency. Yeah. Transfer it to this. Yeah. It's their voice, right? They can clone their image too. And, you know, they could do all this stuff so easily now. Literally, you can go to 11labs.com, a new startup that just got a massive amount of funding. You can upload, you know, a video clip or an audio clip of anybody, and you'll have a clone of their voice. Five seconds, you know, it takes you 5 seconds and click a button, and then it does it.
Geesh. All right, one more question on AI, and then we're gonna move away from this. You had mentioned to me before that you believe AI is going to transform how we communicate. Say a little bit more about that.
So, in every aspect that we communicate differently than we did 10, 20 years ago. You know, I don't even call people on the phone. Everything's texting. So I'm messaging them on my messaging apps. And, you know, instead of calling them, and we'd only have an arranged, it's almost impolite to call somebody out of the blue, unless they're like a very personal friend.
Sure.
You know, we're getting all our news, all our information through the communication. You know, all the information we consume now is being filtered through algorithms. Like literally, whether you're on Facebook, whether you're on TikTok, whether, you know, wherever you are, your news feed now is all algorithmically programmed. A lot of the content is created by AI in the news, and you don't even know it. It's written by AI. So our devices are becoming much more personalized. Literally every input is being dictated by AI and by these algorithms, which are literally a black box. Like, we don't get to see into Meta's, Mark Zuckerberg's black box. We don't get to see into Google's black box. You know, when we go to the search engine, they are deciding what to hand us. Mm. AI is making that decision. Is it the right decision? Is it a decision that will make society better? Because all we are is the information we get. We cannot make decision unless the quality of information is good enough. Number two, a lot of us will be using AI. So in the future, I may be busy. So you may be contacting my digital twin who looks like me, is it basically an AI version of me, who speaks just like me. And you may be scheduling an appointment with me. People may be asking me questions because I'm too busy to answer all the questions that I get from people, you know, in my business. Salespeople, it doesn't matter if you're a salesperson and they're asking you a sales question, like your real estate agent. In the future, it'll be like Hollywood, where it's saying, let my agent talk to your agent. It'll be let my AI agent talk to your AI agent. All of us will have these AIs literally intermediating every conversation and every action and every transaction that we have. AI will be in the middle because it will be very efficient. It'll be very easy to use. It'll make our life much better. But at the same time, we have to ask, what are we losing? What are we losing by doing this? And what are we giving up? You know, our personal voice we're giving up. We're delegating it to AI. Our personal autonomy, because the next big wave of AI are called AI agents. They're not talent agents like Hollywood. These are AI that are smart enough to go out and perform multi-step tasks on your behalf. Whether it's coordinating a meeting, planning an event, you know, scheduling your travel, whatever it is, these AI agents will be doing it. And they will basically be extensions of ourselves. But at the same time, they will be making a lot of decisions for us.
All right, we're going to move off this. I want to get back to building startups. I just had to talk about that for a little bit. What would you say is... We had this conversation also, the biggest myth about launching a startup.
It's myth about launching a startup is that everybody gets rich. You know, most entrepreneurs fail.
Right.
Not everybody gets it.
I was hoping this is what you were going to say.
Most people lose their life savings and go through a lot of pain. It's not easy. Most people aren't actually cut out to do startups. And if they are, you need to know what type of startup you should be doing and what the risk threshold is for you and for that business, you know, how much you should be. And people don't get a lot of training in this. Like most of us, we aren't trained to be entrepreneurs. We study something, whatever it is. Like even your MBA doesn't usually do a very good job of training you to be an actual entrepreneur.
Well, of course not. I mean, this is one of my biggest complaints about the educational system. You know, is that they know how to educate people, but that's not necessarily real life experience.
Because those professors aren't necessarily people who've ever done it.
Like, that's
very
exactly
hard
correct.
They are very good probably at being a professor and being an academic, but being an academic is quite different than being an entrepreneur.
And running a business, that's right.
Very, very different. So
exactly.
The bottom line is, you know, we should be requiring now that everybody take entrepreneurial courses from entrepreneurs in the educational system so that they can actually understand. And then people need to be realistic about what they're good at and what they're not good at. And
right.
And also, how do you build a business? What are the fundamentals you need to evaluate? Most people just dive in on an emotional, like they got laid off from their job. It's not always a good reason to be an entrepreneur because you have no money coming in.
Nothing better to do.
Right. Nothing better to do. Or they don't like their boss. They quit. They, you know, or they have this dream they have.
And working for myself is going to be such a, the cat's meow.
Oh my gosh. Yes. That's the, people are entrepreneurs usually for the wrong reasons. You should be an entrepreneur because you see a problem that really needs to be solved. You see the demand there. You can't create demand in the marketplace. Demand already has to exist. This is something most people fail. They think if I build the most incredible product or I do this thing in my imagination, people will flock to it. It never happens. People are already lined up. There's these pockets of demand in out there in the real world, and you have to tap into them. It's more like a game of discovery than a game of creation. It's finding where the demand is and then building the product to meet that demand. It's right. Kind of the inverse of what most people think of as being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make?
The biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make is to fall in love with what they're doing. Because you can love your product more than anything in the world. I meet entrepreneurs all the time and they go, I've been working on this for 5 years, blah, 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 blah. We put all this into it. I'm like, but what do your customers think? Who's using this? And a lot of times they have almost no customers that really care about their product. And, you know, all of us are blind. We all have our biases about everything in life. And one of the biggest biases is when you fall in love with your product, it's just like, you know, they say love is blind. It is blind, whether it's you're in love with another person or you're in love with your product. You start to believe what you want to believe about it. And I made this mistake, right? I built some really cool products that I just fell in love with. I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. And you know what? Nobody cared. And I spent far too long perfecting a product that nobody cared about. So I like to work backwards, and it was what I was hinting at earlier, going out there, figuring out the customers, figuring out the demand, and then working backwards and building a product to meet that.
Yeah. I think that is the case in many things, and people don't realize it. And, you know, when you talk about people falling in love with their product, that's what I, in my coaching practice, refer to as being emotionally attached to something.
Yes. We get emotionally
attached. When you have that attachment, it's really, really, really hard to let that go. And it's often really not healthy for you. And I'm not referring to relationships. I'm being attached to anything. You just can't be objective.
The only thing I want an entrepreneur to be attached to and fall in love with is their customer. Like if you can fall in love with making your customers happy, you'll figure out a business. At the end of the day, somebody's going to pay you because you care about them so much and you're always trying to solve their problems.
Yeah. Steve, what would you say is the most important thing you look for when investing in a startup? Is it going to be the team first?
always the team first, but I want to, there's some other things. You know, I mentioned the team, the market size, the technological horizon, the venture capital appetite, all these things. There's another thing I really look for. And I like people who don't just build a product or a service, because a product or a service is fine, but a lot of people can copy and they can build the same product or service that you're building. It's not like you're the smartest people that ever lived. There's a lot of smart people out there. You may not have the best access to capital, so other people may raise a lot more capital and then can outrun you. But what I look for is people who are thinking beyond products and services and are building platforms. And I define a platform as something very different. Platforms are ways for you to bring in your customers and your partners, different business partners, and the more they get involved, the more they work on your platform or use your platform, the more valuable that platform is for everybody. So we can look at platforms. I'll give you, every big tech company at the end of the day is a platform. So you look at Amazon, right? Amazon is a platform. The more time people spend on Amazon buying products, reviewing products, making, you know, the more data Amazon gets on which products to stock, which products to recommend, the reviews become valuable for people. The more merchants they can bring in and the more merchants they have, the more other people come in. Platforms become defensible, right? So once a company has a platform, it's very hard for a new company to launch because you get this critical mass. So whatever business you're in, think about how can I get my customers and my business partners, different people in the ecosystem, contributing to my business to make it more valuable for everybody, and especially for our core customers.
You know, I, for many years, because like I said, most of my career has been spent working with small companies, right, and startups, and especially during the tech boom, and hence bust. But so I have my own feelings around why so many large corporations fail to innovate, but what is your opinion on that and why that is? And I'll see if it's the same as mine.
Yeah, I've consulted for a lot of these big corporations, so I saw firsthand what they're doing. So I go into these corporations, and a lot of times corporations make huge mistakes. So first of all, the management there is, they have a big corporate mindset. And they are looking through the lens of a corporation and what they think the corporation can make, which is totally different than the entrepreneur. Because the entrepreneur
and shareholders, I might add, for most of them.
Yes, and shareholders. And they are questioning things where a lot of times inside you're not questioning things. So that's one thing. So in, like I won't name the corporation, but I went there and the first thing they did wrong was they had their executives decide which ideas were the right ideas for them to put money into. They basically asked everybody in their company to come up with new ideas for innovative products and services that they could launch. And this is a multinational Fortune 500 company. And they're actually a Fortune 100 company. And they basically all, so they had all their employees come up with the ideas. Then the management team selected which ideas were good and bad. So they probably weeded out a lot of the great ideas because the management team just wasn't on the same wavelength. Then they picked the products, they picked the ones successful based on the idea, not based on the people. So here was this person in the company who came up with this idea. They might not even be a natural entrepreneur or a natural innovator. They just had an idea that the management liked. So they suddenly get handed a bunch of money to start an innovation team around this idea. Those people, like I said, when I choose startups, I choose them based on the people. They just chose it based on the idea of some random person.
Idea, yeah.
You know, usually in an organization, you need to start with the people. You need to handpick the people who are truly innovative, that truly are pushing the things, that don't follow the orthodoxy of the business, that are looking beyond where the company currently is. Then you need to empower them. They usually fail to empower them. Give them the freedom to actually chart their own course. And when those people in your organization, those innovators, hit a roadblock, you need to give them a way to get around the roadblock. Because a lot of times those roadblocks will just absolutely kill you. Like I had one group, working with one group in this large company. Mm-hmm. They had this amazing medical device that was truly astounding. And it was for surgery. And the surgeons loved it. The patient recovery times were far less. the error rates were far less. And they were like, you know, and they were developing this. And I asked them a question. I said, yeah, all this is great, but do the hospitals like it? Yeah, because the hospitals, aren't they the ones that actually have to sign off on this? The surgeons can recommend it, the patients can ask for it, but the hospitals have to actually sign the bottom line. And you know what they told me? They told me, actually, the hospitals are resisting buying this because they have to change their whole sterilization routines for medical instruments. So they don't want to change that. So they're reluctant to buy it. I was like, okay, why are we making this? Even if and you know right. why they were making it? Because their right. boss, they said, we can't change. Our boss wants us to make it. And our boss sold his boss, Jesus. And none of them want to change. So we're going to continue making this.
Yeah.
That's why corporations fail.
You know,
that's why they.
Right. And I think a lot of what you just said is sort of my feeling, but from, I want to put one more point on that is that, and I am making a generalization here, but I think it's a generalization that's warranted to say the best people don't go to big companies.
It's another reason. The people who remain in the big companies often are not the best, but you do often have some good people, but they're not often natural risk takers. They aren't the type of people.
Right. Well, that's the point. It's a gross generalization. It is a generalization, right? I mean, you know, let's look at Google 15 years ago. They were probably getting all the best people. Are they still?
Well, they're paying salaries that you think would attract the best people. So they are, right. They can attract good people, but often these people get trapped by the culture, trapped by the structure, trapped by all the things I went through, and they aren't able to actually do anything. So even if you get good people, but you're right.
Right.
I was consulting with, I talk to everybody and I go, why can't you be innovative? Why don't you want to do this? And they were like, it'll never happen here. It'll never happen. Nothing will ever happen.
Yeah. And I think when, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking of Apple thinking, boy, what kind of innovation are they doing? Oh, a new iPhone, Yahoo. You know, I'm still on an 11. Everybody else is on a 15. I mean, do I really need a new iPhone?
And they aren't that innovative, right?
No.
They're incremental. Corporations do incremental right. innovation usually.
Right. So, you know, I mean, you know, you have to look at, I mean, if Steve Jobs could be resurrected, you have to wonder, would he be innovating? Like,
well,
really?
He drove that company
coming up
to
with
innovation.
Something new.
He's a true entrepreneur. Like, you know, and the Vision Pro wouldn't look anything like the Vision Pro that they have now. just a copycat of all the other ones out there.
Yeah,
they didn't
yeah.
really go beyond.
Yeah. One of the biggest problems for small companies, and anybody listening to this has ever worked for a small company, especially a startup, gets this, is that they just don't have any money to spend.
Oh, I know.
Like on some stuff that they really should be spending yes. money on, you know, and that leaves the team, whatever that might look like, doing stuff they are not experts at.
I know a lot of.
So how do we solve that problem? Mm-hmm. It's really a problem. I can't tell you the numbers of people who are like, God, I really want to hire you. I don't have any money.
Over and over and over. It's probably one of the hardest problems to solve, because unless you're going to write them a check, a lot of times you're not going to solve that problem for them. The other thing they can do is they do have other resources. So they can give equity if people will take equity to, right?
Of course.
And use that. They can do profit sharing. A lot of time, if they are a business that actually, you know, can make money, you know, it's harder because it's harder to get people who are the best people to take equity or to take profit sharing on an unknown startup.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's the $64,000 question, right? Is what is that balance? I'll never forget a number of years ago, I was doing a search for, a fantastic startup that subsequently sold to a much larger company 6 years after they were founded for over $500 million. And I had never done the CTO knew me. The CEO had reached out to me and said, would you be willing to do a search for sales and software engineers? And I thought, I just to put a bullet between my ears. But these guys were so fabulous, and I knew there was a lot of business that was coming from them. And I agreed to do it. And the first person I found, they fell in love with. And he was somebody at Google, and we could not get him out. And part of it was because this startup, even though they were going to give him, I mean, I think they were, I don't even know if they might have still been in their seed or just haven't closed their A round. And they were going to give him a, I mean, the shares were like 50 cents a share. And these guys, this was disruptive. Yeah. What these guys did. Subsequently, they sold their company for a lot of money, right? And they just, we just couldn't close him because, you know, he was working for Google making a shitload of base salary plus stock and all the rest of that.
That happens.
He would have done extremely well, I might add, had he gone with this company. He would have made a shitload of money.
Right? And also to your point, it's hard to hire those people, get them on board with just equity. It's sometimes even harder to get even consultants like yourself to take equity because you don't even have time to evaluate the startup, right? It's a lot.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I will talk to people about it. Look, I can't take 100% equity. I need to feed myself. Who's going to pay my mortgage? So, you know, if we can figure out something where you pay me this much and you give me this much equity, if I believe in your team, I mean, you're right. I've got to evaluate, is it worth it for me? I made a mistake what year are we in? 24? It would have been the end of 22. Somebody introduced me to a founder in the renewable space. And the very short story is 3 months later, I was like, oh, I got to get out of this. This guy's a disaster. He won't listen to anybody. He's never been a founder before. I mean, I had all these conversations with him. So, you know, but I was referred by somebody I know. He said a lot of the right stuff. And I wasn't giving him a huge amount of my time either. So I don't feel like it was kind of like no harm, no foul, really. But, you know, I look back and thought, okay, what could I have done differently to have analyzed that better?
Yeah. So with entrepreneurs, I tell them you don't have enough money. So you really need to focus on just the core things that you do exceptionally well and forget about everything else. Forget about until you get the money.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really, really important. Oh my goodness. We are almost at an hour, Steve. So we're going to have to cut this. You know, every time I talk to you, I'm like, our conversations are so interesting. Is there anything that I did not ask you that you want to throw in before we sign off?
I will just say, that people, if you're out there right now and you aren't using AI for your business and for your life, I know there's a lot of hype, but you absolutely have to. If, you know, the people, it can make you so much more productive and it can make you stand out so much in whatever field you're in that if you aren't one of the early adopters, you're going to be left, you're not going to be as competitive. You won't be as competitive in the job market. Your company won't be as competitive. You need to be looking at all the different innovations out there and, you know, allocating a certain amount of your time to do that.
Great. Well, Steve Hoffman, Chairman and CEO of Founderspace. Gosh, you know, I just love talking to you. Thank you so much for spending time with me again today.
Sure. And if anybody wants to reach me, you can just go to founderspace.com and you can reach me. All my videos are there. All my books are there. You can get my books and lots of helpful information. So thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. And we'll link to that in the show notes also.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Authentically Successful Show. Don't forget to click follow to hear more. And please leave us an honest review and rating so we can continue to improve and bring you more great stories. If you're interested in being my next guest, please check the episode description for information to apply. This is Carol Schultz. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.